CFR is the fundamental component of nephrology.
So this is the most important message, is how bad creatinine is, resulting 30%. This is really unacceptable, I think.
It takes what we've really needed. It takes the point of care aspect of estimated GFR, but gets us very, very close to a true measured plasma GFR.
We found that lower pulmonary artery pulsatility indices were associated with lower eGFR at baseline, lower eGFR slopes, and an increased need for dialysis.
Welcome to the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Matthew Sparks, and today we'll be joined by Dr. Veronica Costa e Silva. We'll talk about her paper published in CJS entitled Impact of Computed Tomography-Derived Body Composition Analysis on the Performance of GFR Estimating Equations in Patients with Cancer. Welcome to ASN Kidney Translation. Tell us about yourself.
Thanks so much for the invitation. And I'm Veronica Costa Silva. I am assistant nephrologist at the São Paulo State Cancer Institute from the University of São Paulo School of Medicine. And I coordinate the Onconephrology Research Group at our university.
This whole episode is devoted to novel ways we're using GFR. And obviously, we know as nephrologists that both creatinine and cystatin C-based formulas have their problems. And especially in patients with cancer, there's been a lot of work and discussion surrounding that. So tell us a little bit about the background that kind of led up to this paper.
Yes, that's a great question. In 2022, we published a paper, a larger paper called the OncoGFR study, which included 1,200 patients with cancer, in which we had measured GFR based on the plasma clearance of chromoDTA and a number of filtration markers. It's quite heterogeneous and it changed over time. So it's always been a challenge. We see this daily practice that body composition, nutrition, and sarcopenia and fat mass, they do impact the filtration markers, especially sarcopenia in the case of serum creatinine, and how this oftentimes leads to overestimation and errors on the GFR estimate equations. 2 years ago, I was approached by Megan Size and Florian Filterman. Dr. Florian Filterman, for the last 10 years, has been working on a machine learning technique in which he uses to determine and assess objectively the body composition in both the muscle mass and the fat mass at L3 lumbar puncture. So they approached me and said, would you like to assess the body composition in your larger population? And so we did that. We had all the CT scans from our patients. And that was always something that we were envisioning, but we didn't have this tool that's so precise and actually can do the measurement with a standardized way and in a much shorter period of time. We didn't have this capacity here.
Well, we know like the limitations of creatinine. One of the biggest ones is muscle mass. So tell us a little bit about this novel technique that was done. What exactly do you do with the CT scans to ascertain the muscle mass of these patients?
That's a great question. There are a number of tools that we can use in clinical practice to assess body composition. So DEXA has been used for a very long period of time. We all assess bioimpedance, but bioimpedance has some limitations. It doesn't provide a precise number. And so with this group, with Florian, he developed this technique, this machine learning methodology. And he has been working for the last 10 years. And this came even from studies from cadavers in which they assessed the entire body and they were able to demonstrate that if you have one slice at L3, this is quite accurate to represent the body composition, the mass, muscle mass, and the fat mass from the entire body. So they had this kind of research and path to do to L3. And then they developed this machine learning technique in which we present the CT scans, they assess them, because before that was our team was doing here. You had to do this manually. You have to take the CT scan, go slice by slice, and do it in a handy and not so standardized way. And it was much more lengthy. So with this technique, this machine learning is much more standardized. It's much faster and it's quite accurate.
Basically, you need is one CT scan of the abdomen that includes L3 and this machine learning basically figures out exactly the muscle mass, then it can compute that for the whole body.
Yes, the muscle mass and the fat mass. And right now they are developing our ways to, because Florian is actually a chest radiologist by origin. And they are also trying to validate this at a thoracic level, chest level. So this is a very convenient exam. You are actually, we're not increasing the cost. We are using the tool that actually you already had in hand.
That's great. These patients, CT scans are done not just once, but oftentimes multiple times as they're going through their treatment course.
Precisely. We have CT scans from 800, almost 900 patients under chemotherapy, and we are assessing this over time, because this is precisely what you said. Not only that we can see that the patient has a sarcopenia, but also how the cancer treatment impacts this over time.
So can you tell us, what exactly did you do for this study? Which filtration markers, which GFR measurements did you use?
Okay, so what we did from one side, measure GFR based on the plasma clearance of chromoDTA, which is a validated technique. It's very accurate compared to the urinary clearance of inulin, so it's very strong too. So we had measured GFR, we had the filtration markers. So we collected creatinine, cystatin C, B2M, so beta-2 microglobulin, and BTP, beta trace protein. We collected all samples here at São Paulo State, and they sent it to the laboratory of the University of Minnesota, which is the central lab for the CKD Epi Consortium. So we wanted to, so the filtration markers were measured through creatinine, cystatin C through standardized ways, standardized materials, in a single run by the end of the study. We really wanted the methodology to be quite rigorous for that, to avoid variations on the assays. And we had this body composition by the CT scan. We were recruiting patients prospectively, so we have all clinical data. So from since the baseline characteristics, the cancer, we had the previous cancer treatment, so we have all the baseline and the cancer variables.
So the four measures were creatinine, cystatin C, beta trace proteins, and beta-2 microglobulin.
Yes.
I'm curious about the addition of the beta trace proteins and beta-2 microglobulins. What was the rationale for including those two?
We call this the four marker panel. And there is an equation that was published and validated by the CKDF group that was based on creatinine B2M. So we assessed this previously. This is published at AJKD. And the model based on creatinine B2M, it was as accurate as the model based on creatinine cystatin C. So, for example, this was maybe an alternative for centers in which cystatin C is not easily available. And the four marker panel, this is something that was interesting, because in this paper, the four marker panel has a better performance compared to creatinine cystatin C. And this was observed in our larger cohort patients with 1,200 patients. This comes from the concept that actually, we know when we speak about sarcopenia and fat mass, we call this non-GFR determinants. That means that the other factors that affect the filtration markers, that is not GFR. So the whole concept is that different filtration markers are affected by different non-GFR determinants. For example, we know cystatin C was not assessed by sarcopenia, for example, which is great, but cystatin C can be affected by fat mass, by smoking, is usually affected by fat mass, smoking, by inflammation, most likely corticosteroids exposure. So as having a panel of filtration markers tries to accommodate these non-GFR determinants, having in the end a model that actually is more accurate and closer to the true GFR, which was what we observed.
Let's take a step back for our listeners. The rationale for this is that big decisions are made by one number, typically an EGFR, and that could be the dose of chemotherapy, it could be the type of chemotherapy, and this could set a patient up for toxicity, for whether or not the chemotherapy is the proper dose to work. And for the longest time, we've relied upon creatinine-based, and now we've added on cystatin C. So this is a really great paper, because we're going to actually sort of even incorporate more data. And really the exciting thing is the sarcopenic or the skeletal muscle from that CT scan. Anything on table one that you want to point out about the baseline characteristics?
BMI is extremely misleading, because one thing that was also striking with this data is that we had 30% of our patients that with sarcopenia, with low muscle mass. And actually, more than 50% of patients are overweighted or obese. We have convinced that we have larger errors of prescription in this obese, overweight and obese population, which is the increasing nutrition group in cancer patients, are precisely this, the obese sarcopenic.
So just looking at a patient, looking at their weight, cannot tell you
is precisely
what you need to
know. Precisely. I'm sure that we have, you know, I think that paid the price of errors and mistakes and overdose of chemotherapy because of our limitations in assessing accurately, especially muscle mass, and having this overweight and obese sarcopenic patients.
Anything on table one, the general characteristics of the cohort, looks like it's about 465 patients total, 157 that were identified as being sarcopenic based upon this skeletal muscle machine learning algorithm, and about 308 of those were non-sarcopenic. Anything we should note in that general characteristics of this cohort?
This sub-study is a sub-cohort from the our larger OncoGFR study. And for the OncoGFR study, the patients had to have a measured GFR, and measured GFR takes a little bit of time. It takes 6 hours, so the patients had to stay for a longer period of time at the hospital. So our patients had a better clinical performance compared to the overall cancer population. We only have 20% of patients with metastatic disease. In many centers, this proportion is higher. 90% of patients had ECOG performance of only 0 and 1. So these are patients that actually fit. I think that's one important thing. And we have had a larger proportion of patients with gastrointestinal tract cancer. Because, as I said, because the CT scan was done by just for the written praxis. So this is this proportion is higher compared to the overall distribution in our cancer population at large.
Okay. Let's move on to table two and talk about the performance of the EGFR equations. And we have a lot of different measures because we have the creatinine, cystatin C, the combination of both of those. We have the beta-2 microglobulin, the beta trace proteins, and the combination of all those. So that's a lot. Tell us about how each of those perform, both in the sarcopenic population, the overall population, and maybe a little bit about how they perform just with using BMI or other indices.
If I had to highlight something, I would start with that. So we can see here that the EGFR bias for the sarcopenic group is minus 14, which means that the GFR is overestimated based on creatinine for this 14 ml per minute. But more importantly, because we can say, okay, no, 14, if I have a patient with a GFR of maybe 60 or 70, it may not make a difference. But more importantly, which we can remind people, this is the proportion of estimates that are within 30% in the case of P30 or minus P30 of measured GFR. So what we're saying here is that we're accepting a variation that is of 30%, which is, by the way, a lot.
So we're accepting a 30% variation. And then from that, we even have a more of a variation.
Precisely. So here, for example, when we see sarcopenic people based on creatinine having one minus P30 of 40%, this is basically tossing a coin. We don't know what we're doing in patients with sarcopenia. So not only the bias is large, minus 14, but more importantly, is the accuracy is very, very poor. So this is maybe the most important message is how bad creatinine is. We are just accepting that in almost half of the population, we're accepting 30%. This is really unacceptable, I think.
We're just kind of seeing how each of these equations stack up to a measured GFR, and then we're putting in different buckets. Either they're sarcopenic based on the CT scan, looking at the BMI, it's less than 30 or greater than 30, and trying to understand how accurate. And so what performs worse is the creatinine-based EGFR equation alone.
Yes. So creatinine is awful. I think that's one of the most important things, is that how unreliable creatinine is in this sarcopenic population. Okay, and let's see how do we behave adding or assessing all the filtration markers. So in the case of cystatin C, the situation is much better. Bias is only plus 4. Creatinine tends to overestimate and cystatin C tends to underestimate a little bit. So this is what Habner said previously. And more importantly, the accuracy is still poor, improved a little bit. With the combined equation, the bias is minus 5, but accuracy improves. It's 1 minus P30 is 14, but it's still not ideal. We know that from our last recommendations, we need to have an accuracy over 90% of 1 minus P30 below 10%. To be considered actually a parameter of better quality. And getting down here, when we have the four marker panel, we have an accuracy that's lower 10%. The combined equation certainly improves accuracy, but it's still not ideal.
Well, yeah, it's very interesting to see this all like laid out in front of your eyes with all of these different measures so you can really see it firsthand. So sarcopenia, if you can identify it, which is a really accurate way by the CT scan, really makes this creatinine very unreliable. And really, all of them doesn't really get you to zero in the sarcopenic population. But the non-sarcopenic, the combined equation does pretty good.
There's a model that we call the cream marker panel without creatinine. So we have the model here of cystatin, B2M, and BTP. And actually, it's the lowest number if you see here.
Creatinine's a problem child. Creatinine-based eGFR is like your crazy uncle that you invite to dinner. You know how they're going to act. We've been using it for a while. Cystatin C is just a new uncle. We're just figuring out its issues. And all of these, any estimating equation is going to have problems.
Yeah.
And I think what we've identified is a subset of patients with cancer that just has a lot of problems, making it very challenging and the need for this study. Just a question to you about how to use this information. So if you have identified someone who's very sarcopenic,
yes,
would you just throw out the creatinine and say, I'm not even going to look at that? Like, why incorporate it into it when you know there's something that's really going to bias the equation? In an individual patient, I feel like, is that something we should consider or not?
That's a very good point. I think that the issue is that what we have in hand. So, for example, yesterday I was in my clinic. I have a patient that is a candidate planning to start cisplatin, and the patient has previous esophagectomy, so it's sarcopenic, and the creatinine and GFR-based CKDF equation was 91. Should I be concerned? I said, well, most likely, accepting that this is overestimated and we are dealing with a variance of 30%. But the issue in this specific patient, the cystatin C was not available and the measure GFR was still difficult. In this case, for example, the patient has a curative intent. So my suggestion, it would be, okay, I would prescribe cisplatin and check more closely what happens on the first cycle. Because this is what this oncologist was able to do. But we need to understand and explain to the patient that it may be the case that we had the toxicity here, but the intent was curative. So I think that we should do it.
That's the exact problem here, is that we're relying upon this data, and maybe the pharmacist who's not even seeing the patient, all they see is the number. They don't know anything else about them. They're not looking at cystatin C, even if it's available. And the decisions are being made far removed from the individuals that might understand the GFR better. Also, it concerns me with machine learning and identifying patients based upon just numbers and data. That's problematic in that, as we can see from this study, a creatinine-based eGFR might be completely meaningless, but decisions are being made based upon it that are far removed from the point of care. So I guess the question becomes here, how can we get this information to the people that need it, that are making the decisions about dosing medications?
This is the battle of the moment. I know the work is all the time trying to talk and convince and collaborate and talk to people. And so that's why I think right now include all these oncologists and hematologists in our research initiatives and our assistants in our clinical rounds. And so a lot of it, I think, is trying to show up and say, okay, here's the data, and we are seeing this in our daily practice. And so I think that this is really a daily work. I think that I have been working on this for 16 years, and still there's a lot to be done. But the work is precisely that. It's show the data and try to incorporate the teams and the colleagues on the discussions, engage people in the discussions. I think that's us as a scientific community that more and more do these collaborative initiatives, go to the meetings. And so, yes, I think that's a huge challenge for all of us on the oncology field.
And like you said, it might even be the pharmacist that finds the dose. And that could be occurring at a time in which you're not there, or your note might be buried and 50 other notes that are in the chart. And that is a challenge. Really, really curious about the sarcopenic measure. How can we as a community, you mentioned that it might be easily spread to others to use. How do you see this being used in the future?
Yes, hopefully, Florian, he has worked with this for the last 10 years. And right now, the conversations they are trying to have, and I do know that there are other groups trying to work on this as well, is try to make the components, to make the softwares available on the machine so the information could be easily released to us. So we are not there yet, but there is a whole kind of initiative in this direction. And I know from in our institution, there is the urology team right now, for example, is trying to work with some startup companies to even to develop an app in which you can plug this to your system and then the images can provide you more easily, even in your cell phone in some point in the future.
You have the machine learning algorithm, you have the slice of the abdomen, the T3 level, you have the metric for this sarcopenia. How is that going to be incorporated into the EGFR?
Yes, well, okay, Ross, I think that you do mean if you have a perspective in the future to incorporate directly?
Exactly. So like, is it a way to take that data and make it and put it into a GFR equation?
There are initial studies that they developed a small equation based on a small data set. They incorporate the parameter, the muscle mass, but we are not there yet. I think that because for this, we would be a really larger number of patients. But this is something that I think that it can be envisioned. I just think that we need to understand a little bit better. I think that certainly we would need a much larger number of people, of patients, that would include certainly, I think, that much larger number of subgroups. So I think that we are not there yet. But there are some groups trying to work on this right now, to have an equation in which we can incorporate the parameter of muscle mass or the information that patient has sarcopenia and to have some sort of adjustment the same way that you have a beta coefficient for age, for example, in sex and currently on our occasions.
So you would say right now that could be the distant future, but if we had that data now, it would allow us to just say, all right, this patient's sarcopenic, make sure and do not rely upon the creatinine value, get an alternative value or cystatin C or do a measure GFR?
Yes, right now this is what I can do. And then in the future, I think that the data is very initial and we don't have a large number of patients, but I think that in the future it may be the case that we can have an adjustment for that. This is a very good question because precisely, you know, the chief of the oncology team asked me precisely that. Well, I mean, I need an instrument that can be easily and readily applied. I say, I totally agree. I think that right now we can use it to understand that we need a better ways to assess GFR. In the future, it may be the case that we have a more precise way to incorporate this. But I mean, we're not there yet.
What's the next steps for you and your group in disseminating this, getting the word out, future studies? What's next for you guys?
There are a number of things. And the first thing is that we are assessing muscle mass, correct? And when we submitted to CJ's and the reviewer correctly said, I think that maybe we shouldn't call this sarcopenia, we should call this myopenia, because we know that the concept of sarcopenia involves not only muscle mass, but muscle function. And so, for example, right now we have just presented in our presentation at ASN in Houston, our data, and we had a subset of those patients in which we did have said we had the frailty evaluation. And we're able to demonstrate that low muscle strength, also the patients that had lower strength on hand grip and the sit-to-stand test, did also had a larger bias in a poor accuracy compared to the patients with normal strength, even with a normal muscle mass. So, and if the patient is sarcopenic, the error is even larger. So right now we're trying to understand how function and nutrition can also impact, because this is something that could be easily incorporated in clinical practice as well. Also, we have the data to assess the impact of chemotherapy on body composition. So I just not only we have an impact of cancer in body composition, but cancer treatment. We see that we have a huge amount of variations in composition, food ingestion, weight. We can see clearly that it's quite dynamic. So I think that's fundamental for us trying to assess the impact of chemotherapy.
Thank you so much for taking time today to speak with us about your fantastic paper. Congratulations to you and your group. We're talking about a revolution in how we measure GFR. This episode will talk about the transdermal GFR measurement that's published in this issue of JASN. We have Dr. Stuart Goldstein from Cincinnati Children's Hospital, with us here to discuss this really interesting advancement. Stuart, please tell the listeners about yourself.
Hi, Matt. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with everybody and you on this technology. So I'm Stuart Goldstein. I'm a pediatric nephrologist. I practice at Cincinnati Children's Hospital in Cincinnati, Ohio, but I'm also the part-time director of clinical development for MediBeacon Incorporated, based in St. Louis, who owns the technology.
It's very interesting, a pediatric nephrologist. Of course, you're like everywhere. I feel like when there's a new technological advance, you're behind it. So how did you get involved in this transdermal GFR company and this system here?
It's kind of a different road, as you might expect. I was visited by the company CEO, Steve Hanley, and the inventor, the chief scientific officer, Rick Dorshow, about 8 or 9 years ago, as they were starting to do the work on the technology. And they visited me as a pediatrician. Joe Bonventri had recommended me as someone who could help them with their pediatric investigational plan. And as I started speaking with them, and they were very interested in the technology getting into the ICUs, and as you know, I do a lot of work in the AKI field, I said, well, that's exciting. I think the more important area initially will be in drug dosing, onconephrology, CKD. That's where there's going to be more of the immediate application. And for some reason, that resonated with them. And so I started working with them, helping them discuss the clinical use cases, how we would translate it into the field. And I helped them and worked with them with the FDA to ultimately get clearance for the transdermal technology in January of this year.
This is an area I've been watching for a very long time. I have no conflicts of interest with the company. However, I was involved in some of the very early prototypes when they were utilizing this in mouse models. And we really prided ourselves on GFR measurement in mice. And back then, how we used it was a technique with FITC inulin. And you would inject it into the vein of the mouse, and then you would have to basically every few minutes take a little bit of blood from their saphenous vein, and then you would basically then plot out how that green fluorescence from the FITC inulin would die out over time. And it was really, really challenging. We would sometimes miss a time point or wouldn't get the time point exactly right. And then I heard about this technology, and so we currently still have like 15 of the units. And when I saw this moving into the human space, I was like, wow, like we've spent so much time trying to make these equations with creatinine and cystatin C, and this is really truly GFR. So maybe we can just take a step back and just talk about the technology that's currently approved by the FDA for use in humans.
I think that's a really important point because a lot of academic centers like yourself have been using in their preclinical and basic science work the FITC sinistrin version of this device, but that can't be made reagent grade for humans. And so what MediBeacon developed was a molecule called relmipirazine, trade name is Lumitrace, which was engineered by Dr. Dorshow to be a GFR agent in man. And the first thing we needed to do was to demonstrate that exactly is what it was. And so first publication that came out in 2024 compared plasma clearance of relmipirazine to that of iohexol and demonstrated an R squared of 0.998 with a Y-intercept of zero to really show that this was a GFR agent in man. There's no protein binding, there's no tubular secretion, there's no tubular uptake. And so the molecule was also engineered to fluoresce. So it is not a radioactive tracer. It fluoresces and it has what's called a large Stokes shift, which means you excite it with one wavelength of light and it fluoresces with a wavelength of light that is distant to the excitation wavelength. And so the same sensor that's placed on the skin will excite the molecule, and then it'll detect the excitation. And what the algorithm does in the box is that it transforms the change in fluorescence intensity detected on the skin over time into a GFR. And so that's the novel aspect of this device. It's agnostic to skin color. We have tested across the entire range of skin colors. We don't put in the patient's biological sex, their gender, their race, their age, their height, their weight. There's no other cofactor. It's just measuring the decrease in fluorescence intensity over time and then transforming that into a GFR that the physician can use.
It's kind of nice not to have the little E next to the GFR. I mean, it's truly a GFR, but something we've been wanting as a field, something easy to do that doesn't, you know, take a cumbersome scan and radiology can be done there in the office.
Yeah, that is correct. It takes what we've really needed. It takes the point of care aspect of estimated GFR, but gets us very, very close to a true measured plasma GFR when we send patients to nuclear medicine for a nuclear medicine GFR. The other thing that is novel and unique about it, it's not just a one-time measurement in the sense of it being point of care and you get, you know, the one creatinine. A patient who has normal kidney function, the signal to noise is acceptable for about 8 hours until it's all excreted out intact in the urine. And in somebody with CKD stage 4, there may be enough signal to noise for about 18 to 24 hours. Every 15 minutes, a new GFR is read. So now you can start to think about how we could leverage this technology to look for change in GFR in real time. Not in CKD, patients with CKD, but in patients who have potentially acute kidney injury or heart failure and an elevated creatinine. We can use this as a theragnostic to see what happens to the GFR in real time after we perform an intervention in an acute setting. And we're very excited about leveraging that aspect of the technology as well.
I agree. I mean, very excited about that. And being someone that was in the mouse lab for like 10 years and trying to understand how to measure these things in real time, and then think about how to translate this into humans. And it opened your eyes up to everything. I mean, one of the episodes on this podcast is getting at one point in time, right heart cath parameters, and then GFR, and then extrapolating that over time. And having that all real-time data for maybe 24 hours in the ICU and seeing how you have real-time changes in GFR is, I think, really where we need to go.
Yeah, I agree with you, and we're really excited about that. We've done some preclinical studies, one here at Cincinnati Children's Hospital with our congenital heart surgery team. This was a sheep model where we put the sheep on bypass, and immediately as the sheep is put on bypass, transdermally, we can see a decrease in GFR. As we change the flows on bypass, we see an immediate change in GFR slope and in GFR. And then when the sheep is taken off bypass, we see the GFR improve. Interestingly, though, it did not even get back to baseline on post-op day 2. So that's really exciting for us because we wanted to prove that in real time, we could see changes in glomerular filtration rate transdermally. And we also measured the plasma side romapyrazine to make sure that what we were seeing transdermally was reflecting what was going on the plasma side, and it was.
What is the pathway to have a test like this be FDA approved? And then after that, just sort of like where this study and Jason is in that sort of process?
Yeah, so the study that was published in Jason was our pilot data of 74 patients. And then with another 182 patients, we undertook the pivotal trial, again, comparing transdermal GFR to plasma GFR with romapyrazine. The FDA has said that we don't need to compare it to iohexol anymore because romapyrazine they view as a GFR agent in man. And so the Jason article was the pilot data, but the pivotal data were 182 patients. And what FDA required was that our P30 point estimate and lower confidence bound, 95% confidence bound, had to be higher than the 95% confidence bound of eGFR as published by Dr. Levy in the 2009 CKD EPI paper. The P30 metric is the standard metric for all GFR comparisons, and it looks at how many of the transdermal GFR measurements in this case are within 30% of the measured GFR on the plasma side. And so we met the endpoint. Our P30 was 94 with a lower bound of 89%, which was higher than the upper bound of 86% by CKD epi. And so based on that, MediBeacon received FDA clearance in January of 2025 for measurement of GFR in patients with a GFR of 15 to 120 mils per minute per 1.73 meters squared, and they have to have stable kidney function. There's no other restriction. Doesn't matter what the patient's size or age is, what their underlying diagnosis is. As long as they have stable kidney function, it's cleared. Now, what I'll say is that was using the first generation sensor. We're now working and should hopefully in the near future have the second generation sensor approved. And all I can tell you is the performance is even better with the second generation sensor than what was published in JASN and what the pivotal data were to get clearance.
And I was going to clarify for our listeners, you have the transdermal data. And what exactly is the comparator? Because you said they didn't have to have a comparator of iohexol. What is the comparator here? Is it
the comparator was blood side realmapyrazine. So the same tracer. So they said we didn't need to do any iohexol comparisons anymore. We could compare the transdermal fluorescence intensity decrease to our blood side plasma clearance.
So what's the difference in the first generation and second generation?
The main difference is that the second generation will be a reusable sensor. So the first generation was a single-time sensor that was placed on the chest. And now the second generation will have a disposable ring. And in the United States, that sensor will be able to be reused up to 20 times. We have approval in China as well, and we're able to reuse the sensor more up to 100 times. But the optics have been refined so that we are able to have even greater fidelity to how the transdermal fluorescence signal is reflecting what's going on the plasma side. I unfortunately can't tell you what the P30 is, but you'll just have to trust me, it's significantly better than what we received approval for.
So tell me about that P30 value. It's written here, it's 91.9%. What does that mean for a nephrologist?
That is such a great question, Matt, because while this is how eGFR or GFR or transdermal GFR is evaluated, we as nephrologists don't practice that way. We don't practice with a P30. Again, what it means is what percentage of measurements are within 30% of the measured value. But we practice more on CKD staging in this field. And we did have a paper published in the Clinical Kidney Journal, which demonstrated when we looked at plasma side realmapyrazine to eGFR, how often did eGFR misdiagnose CKD stage? It misdiagnosed it by 35% of the time. And most of the misdiagnosis was in the CKD stage 2 to 3 to 4 area. That's where it really matters for the patient. That's where it really matters when we're thinking about drug dosing as physicians. And the other problem was there wasn't any bias. It wasn't that eGFR either overestimated or underestimated GFR. It was equally distributed. So you couldn't even just put a cofactor in. And there's a paper I was just mentioning to you beforehand that was just published in JASN that looked at the same thing, looking at eGFR in frail patients and in overweight patients, and saw the same misclassification with eGFR by cystatin C or a combination with creatinine. So we've been really hamstrung by eGFR equations and misdiagnosis of CKD stage for drug dosing and how often patients have to come back to clinic. What kind of labs do we need to get for them? So I think this is a real advance for us to have something that is so much closer to true measured GFR.
Exactly. You get a patient and you're making a big decision about a chemotherapy dose or about a medication that need to change the dose of the drug as well. And And the cutoff is 30, like 28, 29, 30. Like, and there's differences in what you do for each of those numbers. Then you get a cystatin C, and it's a different number. Which one do you use? Do you do a combination of both? This seems like a more precise method to do this. Now, I guess the challenge in this is that we order creatinine all the time. How can we then utilize this in clinical medicine? Is there a particular, you know, GFR that you get, you know, say, okay, well, their GFR is around 30 to 35, we have a big decision to make. Is that the time that's when you would use this?
Yeah, I think you kind of answered the question for yourself, Matt. It's when is really knowing the GFR truly going to impact the decision that you make? You and I both know if a patient has a GFR of 100 versus 110 versus 120, we're not going to make it. That's not where transdermal GFR methodology is going to be helpful for you or for the patient. But when you're hovering around 60 or you're hovering around 40 and you really need to know, then TGFR is likely going to be the solution for you. Again, it's not just one point in time. The transdermal fluorescent detection is happening 2.5 times per second. So these GFRs are being derived from thousands and thousands of data points as you're going through the procedure, which is really exciting. The other place where we're very interested, and I know you would be too, is in kidney transplant donors. We really need to protect donors. And we're often looking at EGFR. And what if their EGFR is 95 or it's 85? Well, then what do you do then? Do you send them for a nuclear GFR scan or do you have them do a 12-hour urine collection, which is cumbersome? This is where we're really, really interested in protecting donors. And maybe some donors are actually ruled out who could actually be safe to donate. And there are other donors who are ruled in who maybe they shouldn't donate. And we're thinking even of doing renal functional reserve in donors to really make sure that it's safe for them to donate. And so I think this is another area where really knowing the GFR in a healthy patient probably is the right thing to do.
Are there any clinical scenarios that we need to consider this not being as accurate for? Let's say someone with bad nephrotic syndrome and has just lots of edema, almost weeping edema. Does remapyrazine like sort of leach out into like other areas, like when you're having nephrotic syndrome? Does that happen?
You know, that's a great question. And these are things that we need to study. So we don't know the answer to that yet. We're all very interested in what happens in the acute setting when patients are in septic shock and they have leaky vessels. What happens to remapyrazine in that instance? Or when patients get a fluid bolus? And these are all things that we're studying preclinically. I think that the technology's performance will still work well because it's not just a single point in time measurement, as I've mentioned. Patients will get on the curve and then there will be a slope of decreasing fluorescence. So as long as we're not doing anything acutely to the patient, we likely wouldn't see a change in GFR. Now, we've done some initial preclinical work where we've given fluid boluses to an animal, and we can see an immediate blip in the GFR. So the GFR seems to increase a little bit because we've diluted remapyrazine. But within about 5 to 10 minutes, it gets back on the slope, and the GFR starts to get calculated again. So it's a really good question. We don't know exactly how this will work, but we plan to test it in all patient populations.
One of the things I know from the mice is that I had to keep them very still. Can a patient walk around when they have this thing on them? Or I guess right now it's kind of wired, but when the wires come off, is that possible to like get up and walk to the waiting room? Or are they going to have to sit in a chair for the entire duration?
Yeah, they don't have to sit in a chair for the entire duration. So the way the technology works is putting the sensor on the patient. It will take about 15 minutes to adjust for the patient's skin color and their background fluorescence. I didn't know this, but you and I fluoresce, everyone fluoresces. So it then gets a baseline fluorescence. And that's when we've asked for the patient to be still. So for about 15 minutes, and then it's a 7 mL bolus injection of realmapyrazine through an IV. And it takes about an hour and a half to equilibrate across the total body water. But once the injection is completed, the patient is able to walk around. They're able to take their normal medications. They're able to eat a diet. So they are not confined after the injection is complete.
So how long does it take to get one measurement on a patient? Say if they're in an onconephrology clinic and you identified them as someone that you might want to make a dose adjustment on in their chemotherapy, how long would it take?
Yeah, no. Somebody with normal kidney function, for us to feel very comfortable in the curve, after that 90 minutes of equilibration, it can take another hour to hour and a half to get the first reading, what we call a snapshot GFR. And just like with iohexol or iothalamate, for patients who have decreased kidney function, it may take an additional half hour to hour till you feel like you get enough data. We are working with some experts in machine learning to see if we can start to look at the slope a little bit earlier and feel comfortable about decreasing that time to getting the first GFR. But I do believe the earliest we will be is about 2.5 hours after injection, which is why I think ultimately the wireless sensor is going to be a game changer because the patients aren't having to wait around.
Would it be possible to inject this and then go home?
Yes, that would be the ultimate goal, is to be able to inject it and then go home because the sensor's there and they mail the sensor back. And there are a lot of onconephrology clinics, as you know, that are doing at-home chemotherapy. So you could imagine that we could even take this to the at-home company. You know, those patients generally have a port. They could get their GFR in 2.5 hours that day, and then the oncologist would know exactly how much to dose the patient that.
Oh, that's fascinating. How long does it take to get a nuclear medicine GFR? Do you know?
Well, I think the minimum is about 2 to 3 hours, but then you have a dedicated suite, right? The patient has to sit there, have a dedicated suite, have a radiologist read that. The scanner, the shortest I've ever seen has been about a 2 hour. So it's about the same. Two and a half hours, yeah.
I'm really looking forward to this being integrated into clinical medicine. I'm really rooting for this technology. I mean, GFR is the fundamental component of nephrology. What do you see the future of this technology?
I think that this technology will be applied in patients who are really, really at risk for errors in drug dosing based on GFR. And you can think of a number of patients. We've already spoken about onconephrology. You know, as those patients go through their chemotherapeutic course, they lose muscle mass, they become more frail, their creatinines go down, so their eGFR goes up, and they get misdosed and overdosed. But you can also think about other patients. Patients who are overweight or obese, they're inflamed, their cystatin Cs may be falsely elevated, so their eGFRs are too low and they may not get the appropriate dose of medication they need. As a pediatrician, I'm very interested in patients with Duchenne's muscular dystrophy. It's one of the first places we're going to go. Those patients have a creatinine of less than 0.15 milligrams per deciliter. They're all on steroids for their cardiomyopathy, so cystatin C is inaccurate in them. So you can think about any population, if you're looking at stable kidney function, where drug dosing is based on GFR. And then the whole area of critical care medicine, heart failure, septic shock, patients who have rapidly fluctuating GFRs, where we as clinicians have an intervention and we have to wait 12 to 24 hours to see if that intervention helped the patient's kidney function. We should be able to know that now within 30 minutes transdermally. CRT drug dosing, we did an initial study we've published with David Humes where we could demonstrate what the true clearance of meropenem was in a pig model on CRT as we changed the effluent dose. think it's going to change drug dosing in the ICU as well, because you'll know the true clearance with acute dialysis. So that's where I see it going, but I think there are probably many other areas that I'm not aware of.
Seems like we got a lot of papers coming to read in the future, and I hope to see this in all hospitals in the future. Well, thank you so much for taking time to join us on the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast. We hope you had a great time listening to this episode. Thank you, Stuart. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Matt. It really was a pleasure, and appreciate all of your support through my entire career.
We're joined by Dr. Marcel Tuttle from Tufts University. We'll be talking about her paper titled Novel Hemodynamic Markers and Kidney Function in Patients with Acute Decompensated Heart Failure. Welcome to ASN Kidney Translation. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hi, my name is Marcel Tuttle. I'm a third-year nephrology fellow at Tufts Medical Center in Boston, who's broadly interested in cardiorenal syndrome and disentangling mechanisms of heart failure and kidney function.
Congratulations. Also, not many fellows are pursuing research right now. We as a community have a lot to do to ensure your success. So tell us a little bit about this project. When did it start? And what question were you trying to answer?
Yeah, so we started this project when I was a second year resident at Tufts. And as a resident, I was always curious as to why our heart failure patients were, some of them had declines in kidney function, some of them didn't, some of them were progressing to dialysis, some of them didn't. And really, I was interested in trying to disentangle the mechanisms as to why that was happening. At Tufts, we have a really sick heart failure population where we have many patients getting right heart catheterization procedures and leave-in Swan-Ganz catheters. And so this project was to try to disentangle those mechanisms.
This is a very common question we get when we're rounding in the hospital. And so I guess maybe we can talk a little about the background and what was known about left ventricular function, right heart function before this paper, and what were you looking at as sort of body of knowledge before embarking on the study?
So prior to this, there had been a lot of work looking at things like central venous pressure, which is the right atrial pressure, as well as cardiac index, and trying to link those to kidney function. And what people had found was that elevated central venous pressure or congestion was highly associated with declines in kidney function, but there wasn't really a strong signal for cardiac index. So in the cardiology literature, there were two new hemodynamic markers. One was called pulmonary artery pulsatility index, or PAPI, which was defined as the pulmonary artery pulse pressure over the central venous pressure. The other was called aortic pulsatility index, or API, which was the systemic pulse pressure over the pulmonary capillary wedge pressure, or which is a proxy for the left atrial pressure. And so both of these markers were thought to be more complete composites of right ventricular function for PAPI and left ventricular function for API, because they incorporated both the filling pressures as a proxy for congestion and the pulse pressures as a proxy for the pulsatility of each ventricle.
So you say these are, in the cardiology literature, emerging markers. Can you tell us why we haven't heard about these?
Yeah, so they were primarily studied in retrospective studies of heart failure patients. And they were primarily looking at cardiovascular outcomes, so mortality, how well the outcomes after left ventricular assist device or LVAD placement. They also looked at cardiovascular composites. And so I think the reason that the nephrologists weren't as aware is, one, they were emerging and not as commonly used in clinical practice, particularly because I think the subset of patients getting right heart catheterizations is quite small outside of specialized cardiovascular centers.
I'm very interested to see what you did to figure this out. So you said you started this as a resident. Tell us about the steps you took to get the data and what the data looked like.
All of these cardiac catheterization procedures, the way that they recorded the data at the time, it was actually all on paper printouts that were then scanned into the chart. So me and my co-resident at the time and co-author Run, we actually went through all of these scanned in papers and recorded all of the hemodynamic values and then calculated PAPI and APPI based on that. And then we were able to, through the Tufts Clinical Translation Science Institute, we were able to pull lab values and medications and comorbidities from the charts automatically.
So it looks like you went from 2015 to 2021. Curious, what year did they start becoming put into the system, or was it all paper the entire way?
It was all paper the entire way. They got, basically, it would just scan the PDF in. We switched over to Epic, I believe, in 2022. And so now they're being manually put in.
So how many records did you go through?
The total cohort is 753 patients that were included. I think we screened about 1,000 for the inclusion and exclusion criteria.
Wow. That's a lot to go through.
Yeah.
Well, tell us about when you made the study design. Like, what were the parameters that you wanted to look at? And of course, being a clinical study, I'm sure you had to have this a priori so that the results are more meaningful.
Yeah. So at the outset of the project, we were interested in PAPI and API. We were also interested in CVP and the role of congestion broadly. So those were our a priori hypotheses.
And then what were the parameters you were looking at for what they were associated with?
Yeah. So we were looking at whether it was associated with baseline GFR, decline in in-hospital GFR slope, as well as whether long-term they were associated with dialysis outcomes. So as part of this, we merged the data with USRDS to look at whether these patients received dialysis long-term. We were interested on whether it was associated with mortality in a composite of heart transplant, LVAD, and mortality.
So you said you screened over 1,000 patients, ended up with 753. What were some of the exclusion criteria that sort of whittled away that larger number?
We excluded patients if they were started on dialysis before PA catheter placement, if there wasn't a GFR obtained within one day, or if they received mechanical circulatory support before PA catheter placement.
Yeah, it makes sense because those were all your outcomes. They already had your outcome to start with. Tell us about the baseline characteristics of your cohort.
Overall, this was a pretty sick heart failure population. At baseline, the mean ejection fraction was 29%. They also had a relatively well-preserved GFR with a GFR of 58. And a fair amount of them are on inotropes at baseline, around 30%.
What was their comorbidities?
There was also quite a few with hypertension and diabetes, 37% and 39% respectively.
First, you can talk about what their baseline cardiovascular hemodynamic monitoring was.
At baseline, they had a moderately elevated CVP, I would say, of 13. Their pulmonary artery pressures were elevated on average with a pulmonary artery systolic pressure of 54 and a pulmonary artery diastolic pressure of 27. Wedges were also elevated at 23, and their cardiac indices were on the borderline of 2.1 on average. PAPI and API were both on the lower side. The mean PAPI was 2 and the mean API was 1.8.
Okay, so I'm trying to understand that. The lower the PAPI or PAPI, that is akin to worse right ventricular function.
Correct.
And I'm trying to understand this. So if you have someone with a high CVP, let's say in this study, average was 13. So we'll give this hypothetical person a 13. And then basically you're going to have to then look at the pulse pressure of the pulmonary artery. And so a lower pulse pressure would then equate to a lower PAPI.
Correct.
And can you explain the physiology around that?
So the thought is that as your right ventricle fails, your pulmonary artery pulse pressure is going to decrease and your central venous pressure could potentially increase. So both of those would lead to lower pulmonary artery pulsatility index.
And then let's talk about the API.
API, it's basically the same story, but on the left side. So as your left ventricle fails, your systemic pulse pressure would go down, and then you would theoretically have higher filling pressures on the left side of the heart, so your wedge would increase. So by incorporating both the pulse pressure of how well the ventricle is squeezing and also the filling pressures, it's thought to be a more holistic measure of how the left side of the heart is functioning.
And again, the lower number, the worse it's functioning?
Correct.
The average PAPI and API was 1.8. Can you give us some context on how severe that is, or what does that mean?
Yeah, I would say they're basically borderline. A PAPI less than 2, my understanding is that is thought to be a warning sign that somebody would not do well after they had an LVAD placed, because it would mean that their right ventricle is struggling. And similarly, I think API is on a similar scale.
And how much of this is changed with like volume removal? Say, can you improve these numbers? Is this indicative of volume overload, I guess is the question.
Yeah, it could definitely be due to the filling pressures themselves being elevated. For this paper, we didn't look at change over time, but that's definitely something interesting to look at to see if how reversible these markers are.
So this is like a snapshot in time for these patients, and then you look at the outcome thereafter.
Correct.
So we're starting with borderline numbers. So you have a splay of some that are lower and then some that are higher. And so that gives us some idea about whether or not right ventricular function affects these outcomes of kidney function decline, need for dialysis, or is it primarily driven by the left heart? And it does seem that when I was a fellow, we were all concentrated on the left heart, and that was 15 years ago or more. And now it seems like we're way more sort of trying to understand the right heart. However, getting good data surrounding the right heart is really hard.
Yeah, correct. And I think that's one of the strengths of this data set. You know, a lot of other studies have looked at right heart function or dysfunction based on things like echocardiogram, which unfortunately, just due to the topology of the heart, it's much more posterior and difficult to visualize. So right heart cath is a pretty good way of getting a better idea of how well the right heart is doing.
Let's move on to what did you find?
We found that lower pulmonary artery pulsatility indices were associated with lower eGFR at baseline, lower eGFR slopes, meaning more negative, and those patients in follow-up also had an increased need for dialysis over time. That being said, PAPI was not associated with mortality or our composite outcome of heart transplant, LVAD, or mortality. As a sensitivity analysis, we also adjusted for CVP to see if we could try to tease apart the role of congestion here. And we found that our results were attenuated and were no longer significant.
Interesting. So a volume overloaded patient with evidence of right heart failure is bad in, as far as kidney outcomes go. But if you remove the volume, potentially it might go away?
Potentially, although it's hard because, you know, we say if we remove the volume, it'll go away. But if we remove the volume, is that actually going to adjust the CVP at the end of the day? I don't think it's necessarily one-to-one.
And what you do in one day might not be what happens the next day.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a very, very dynamic process.
Exactly. And then when we looked at API, lower API, we didn't see any association with any of our kidney outcomes or mortality, although it was associated with an increased risk of the composite.
Interesting. So it seems like in sum, the right heart is very, very important. Its function is very, very important and intrinsically linked to kidney function. Left ventricular function might not have as strong of a relationship, but overall, still important.
Yeah, precisely.
Well, that's very interesting. So I guess maybe what is the clinical context? Like if I'm rounding on the hospital and now I'm going to start looking at these reports, what can I do to help the patient out? Or is it just, these are just associations we're not really quite sure? Is it paying more particular attention to volume? Is that where we need to go with this?
I think being meticulous about volume is always a first step. I think, unfortunately, we don't know from this study, at least, you know, how and if we can intervene on the PAPI and what to do clinically. I do think that this does draw attention to the fact that right ventricular function is very important for kidney outcomes in these heart failure patients, and that more studies needed to really understand the relationship between the right heart and the kidney at the end of the day.
Well, one of your interests is trying to untangle this. So what are the next steps?
In terms of next steps for this study, we also looked at the relationship of CVP and longitudinal declines in kidney function as well as wedge. And so that paper was actually published by one of our residents at Tufts in AJKD. So people can check that out as well. And then I think in terms of other next steps, it's just thinking of one way to think about this paper is that also that, you know, we've artificially sliced things into right ventricular dysfunction and left ventricular dysfunction, but these things, of course, don't happen in a vacuum, and they're very interlinked.
Thank you so much for joining us here in the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast. Also, congratulations as a nephrology fellow to staying engaged in research and answering important questions, especially this one. We see it every day. So thank you for taking time with us to talk about your study.
Thank you so much.
This podcast is copyrighted by the American Society of Nephrology. All rights reserved. All content in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be medical advice. This podcast should not be used in a medical emergency or for the diagnosis or treatment of any medical condition. Please consult your doctor or other qualified healthcare professional if you have any questions about any medical condition or before taking any drug, changing your diet, or commencing or discontinuing any course of treatment. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the American Society of Nephrology.